From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Call it the case of the missing bees. Somewhere between 30 and 60% of bee colonies around the country have gone missing. And disappearing bees could have a disastrous impact on agriculture, given that everything from apples to almonds depends on bee pollination. What's going on? In the hour ahead, we'll hear from scientists who are trying to solve the mystery of the missing bees. That's our focus. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Did you know that every third bite you take depends on bees? About one-third of the American diet is connected one way or another to bee pollination. Apples, peaches, almonds, and more all wouldn't be part of your daily diet without bees. In fact, according to a Cornell University study, $14 billion worth of seeds and crops in the United States are bee-dependent, which makes this year's mysterious bee disappearance both spooky and potentially disastrous. In states all across the country, beekeepers have discovered that their bees have gone missing. In California alone, between 30 and 60% of bee colonies have disappeared, and no one is sure why. Could it be a virus? Could it be pesticides? The weather? Nobody knows for sure. And to make the missing bee investigation even more complicated, there are no dead bodies, no bee corpses to provide any clues. They're just gone. All of which has left beekeepers, farmers, and scientists perplexed and concerned. So given the importance of bees, we wanted to take up the case of the missing bees this morning. Joining us to do that, Mae Birnbaum. She chairs the entomology department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana and wrote an op-ed piece about missing bees this week in the New York Times. She's also the author of Buzzwords, A Scientist's Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. Dr. Birnbaum, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Jerry Bromenschenk joins us as well. He's a professor at the University of Montana, where he specializes in ecotoxicology and environmental chemistry. Among other research interests, he's currently studying the effects of genetically altered pesticides on bees. Professor Bromenschenk, good morning.
Good morning.
And here, too, is Eric Musson. He's extension apiculturist at the University of California, Davis, and the author of Beekeeping in California. Eric Musson, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Dr. Birnbaum, start us out by describing a little bit more about the importance of bees. When I've described that we were doing this topic this week to a couple of friends in recent days, they've been initially sort of curious, thought it was sort of an amusing story, the missing bees, thought about honey, but were really sort of surprised by this more crucial role that bees play in American agriculture. Walk us through why bees are important.
Well, bees are important in beyond honey and beeswax, which is what most people associate with honeybees, because they are the premier pollinators of the world, actually. They have a very elaborate, lots and lots of species pollinate, thousands of animal species are pollinators. And the vast majority of flowering plants that dominate all our terrestrial ecosystems rely on animal partners to move their pollen around. Pollen is essentially plant sperm, if you will, and if you're rooted firmly to the ground, there's not very many effective mechanisms to get it to the right place. Animal pollinators, in exchange usually for a reward, can transport that pollen, and there are all kinds of ways that insects and other animals can transport pollens, but the honeybees are exceptionally talented at this. They have an elaborate social system. They can communicate with each other. They have large colony sizes. So because of this communication system, when they find a floral source, or they find a flower ready for pollination, they can pinpoint its location, go back to the colony, give instructions to their fellow foragers, and then effectively return to the same species of flower and effect pollination. Plus, they're very flexible. They can learn to handle all kinds of different types of flowers. Many other lesser bees, as it were, can handle one or two kinds of flowers, and that's it. So they're versatile. We've learned how to manage them to some degree. We can transport them, deliver them whenever they're needed, and no technology has been developed that is even a fraction as efficient as a honeybee.
Yeah, it's really an interesting point you made, and you made it in your editorial this week in the New York Times, that for all of the technology that we commonly now associate with American agriculture, there's nothing that replaces the bee.
There would have to be dozens, if not hundreds, of specialized devices. I mean, we can't even conceive of it. I mean, we're not even on the road to replacing the honeybee.
And Eric Musson, describe for us what the California agriculture in particular, but more broadly as well, would be like, or what it would face, given if bees, in fact, were gone.
Well, the interesting thing is that out here in California, we actually have about 50 crops that have to be pollinated. And across the U.S., I think it's closer to a total of 90. And although we think of almonds, apples, cherries, and some of those things, that, you know, it's just normal. Bees pollinate those. But what we tend not to think about is the fact that if you want to plant a carrot seed and get a carrot in the garden in your backyard the season earlier somewhere, they had to let the carrots go to flower, and honeybees come and pollinate those so you could get the seed. And this is true for most of our vegetables.
So what's going on this year, Jerry Bromenschenk? We have this strange phenomenon where beekeepers are going out and looking to opening their boxes of bee colonies, and they're gone. So describe what's happening and what the consequences of this disappearance might be.
Well, describing what's happening, as you said in your introductory comments, this first came to light when beekeepers, primarily those that were staging their colonies to go into the almonds, walked out to inspect their bees and to grade them, getting ready to move, load them on the trucks, open the boxes, and instead of finding booming strong colonies, were shocked to find empty boxes, or at best a queen and a very small number of very young bees, and everything else in the box was gone. The old bees were gone, and even more interestingly, a lot of the pest insects that would normally invade and take advantage of a chance to get at unprotected honey and wax, wax moths, hive beetles, they were gone too, almost like rats abandoning the ship. This is unprecedented. Normally when you have a problem like this, you would expect to find dead bees in the bottom of the box in front of the hive in the yard. Pesticide kills will do that. Beekeeper walks in the yard and sees piles of bees laying around. He knows he's had a pesticide problem. But this case, the bees just vanished. Now, whether or not this is something new, a new pesticide, something the bees keepers use to control mites, a new virus, the fungus, all those are possibilities. But the bottom line is that, again, as you mentioned, there are no dead bees around, so it's like trying to conduct an autopsy with no bodies to look at.
Yeah. Let's pursue that for a moment, because that's exactly the analogy that I think I was thinking of, and probably many of our listeners are as well. It's hard to conduct an investigation if you don't have the body. So what's significant about that? Because there have been many episodes in the past where bees have had problems and we've lost colonies. What's so significant about the missing bee, the not only that they're missing, but that there aren't any dead bodies?
Well, it means that, to the best of our knowledge, those bees flew out the door and never came home. Well, we don't know whether they fly out the door some every day and just don't find their way back or die of exposure, or whether they left en masse. Interestingly enough, with millions of bees that have vanished from these colonies across the United States, we only have two anecdotal reports of anyone that thinks they've even seen it happen. It can happen very, very fast. The beekeepers originally thought it happened over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, and that's simply because it had been 2 to 3 weeks since the last time they looked in the boxes. We now have reports of beekeepers who have looked in their boxes and saw strong hives on one day, and 2 or 3 days later came back and found their colonies decimated. So, this is not totally unprecedented. There have been mysterious disappearances of bees all the way back to the turn of the century, although to the best of my knowledge, and Eric can correct me on this if he has other information, but to the best of my knowledge, the first time that something very similar to this was seen was in the early 1960s and hit Louisiana, Texas, and spread to a half a dozen other states. And interestingly enough, it is so close to what we're seeing at the moment that you could almost reissue the report from the 60s, change a few names and a couple of the guesses as to what's causing it, and you would be describing what we're seeing now.
Well,
so it might be something old, the cyclical. It might be something new.
Yeah, let's talk about what some of the possibilities are, May Birnbaum. As Jerry Bromenschenk was describing, there have been cases perhaps somewhat similar in the past, and there have been problems with mites and things like that. But walk us through what some of the possibilities might be.
Well, you know, one consequence of writing a New York Times op-ed piece, one of the upside is millions of people read it. The downside is millions of people read it and then email you with their theories. And it's, but the thing is, at this point, we can't really rule anything out. Likely candidates include known bee pathogens, including and bees, because they live in cities, you know, in very crowded conditions and have frequent contact with one another. So epidemics are, you know, can get started easily. And there have been there's been transmission of parasitic mites, pathogenic fungi, bacteria, viruses, and the like. But those all leave corpses.
Yeah, exactly.
And but then it's been suggested possibly it's a sort of multiple stress reaction that affects the behavior. And this is sort of key, that honeybee behavior is really extremely sophisticated and very complex. So it wouldn't take much to sort of to reach a tipping point. So
how would bees get stressed out? I mean, I read in one article that bees might be getting exhausted. I mean, what would be the stressors in bee life, I guess?
Well, one candidate, one theory that has yet to be definitively examined is that there are some new pesticides, one in particular, it's called a neonicotinoid, and it works on the nervous system, like many pesticides do, and there are reports from the U.S. and elsewhere that although the pesticide is not lethal to bees, and of course for EPA registration, there is comprehensive testing of toxicity, there's evidence of sublethal effects on behavior. So one conceivable scenario is that basically the bees are experiencing brain damage of one form or another that interferes with their exquisitely sophisticated system of navigation and orientation, and they just get lost.
They're out there perhaps still somewhere, but they literally can't find their way home.
And if they can't find their way home, a bee cannot survive very long outside its own hive, and they just die. They starve to death.
Now, Jerry Bromenschenk, that's part of what you're looking into, right? Some of what might be going on with these new pesticides?
Well, actually, the group at Pennsylvania State University is focusing on the neonicotinics, although we've done a lot of work with that. And we have a technology transfer company called BeeAlert that is affiliated with the university. We have region's approval, but all of our involvement in this is actually through our small company. Courtesy in part of the U.S. Army Center for Environmental Health Research, who funded us to see if we could use bees as a canary to look at sublethal effects in response to, say, a terrorist releasing the cloud of poison gas. The interesting thing is that we found that the sublethal effects of a whole range of chemicals, solvents, industrial chemicals, chem warfare agents, all have effects on the behaviors of bees. So we don't have to invoke the neonicotinics specifically for things that could affect bee behavior or this, you know, fly out the door and can't find their way home or forget what they're doing, because our data shows us that the only reason the neonicotinics came to the fore as a candidate is because somebody with a history of problems with that particular set of pesticides, somebody started looking at sublethal effects with that category. If you factor in the work we're doing, there's any number of environmental, agricultural, and other chemicals that could induce the same type of effect. So, yes, chemicals are a very, very important candidate as what might be flushing everything out the door.
Huh.
And we're taking the broader look. So, you know, there's a large team looking at this. We all take our areas of expertise. So we're looking at kind of everything other than the neonicotinics. For example, some fungi may produce toxins that are repellent or insecticidal. And since everything leaves these boxes, and then for 2 to 3 weeks, nothing comes back. And then eventually the pests come back, the bees start robbing it suggests there's something that builds up in those boxes that it almost has a repellent effect and dries them out. And that's one of our focuses, is try to look at that.
I'm interested in your phrase, that bees function as a kind of a miner's canary. Pick up on that, if you would, Eric Musson, about whether or not bees are perhaps telling us something about the overall state of the environment. Is that a possibility, that there is something going on more broadly, and that because bees are so sensitive, they're telling us something?
That's a possibility. What hasn't been discussed up to this point in time is that unless the new pesticides are involved or something, the most stress that you could generally put on a honeybee colony was to not feed it adequately. During the summertime, they're raising 1,000 bees a day, and 1,000 are dying a day. The ones that die fly out into the field and don't come back. I mean, that's just the way bees do it. Otherwise, you'd have these huge piles of bees around the hives, and that doesn't happen. So when you reach August and September, we aren't rearing six-week bees anymore. We're trying to rear six-month bees because we're not going to have food and brood rearing during the winter. So these bees have to make it through a prolonged period of time. And if those bees do not get adequate amounts of pollen, or if they don't get adequate quality of pollen, then they are very stressed physiologically.
So what would cause them to be starving? What is it that's going on to get their usual source of nutrition?
Almost always it's nature and it's weather. If you get much of a drought, you begin to change the composition of the pollen. If you get too much drought, I mean, the plants don't even make it. And if you look at the map of the last year's drought map for July, almost the whole, at least more than half of the central United States was completely covered with drought, and we had a little out here, and there was some in the east. It just looks as though weather also could have been a serious factor in this. And the global warming as such, with a tenth of a degree change in temperature, wouldn't hurt the bees or the plants. But if global warming is going to begin to give us longer and more dry drought periods, and if we're going to get worse storms and we're going to get more freeze and this, that, these, and those, and the plants that the bees normally rely on aren't going to be there to give them the food that they need, then there's really going to be a problem.
Yeah. Eric Musson is extension apiculturalist at the University of California, Davis, and the author of Beekeeping. He joins us this hour along with Jerry Bromanchuk, professor at the University of Montana, and May Berenbaum, the chair of the entomology department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. May Berenbaum, pick up on the weather part of this. Does that seem to you a possible culprit?
Well, you know, as I said, one can't really rule out anything at this point, but there's been weather since the late 19th century, and these intermittent reports of dwindled seas or fall dwindle or all kinds of things, it sort of appears under different guises. And, you know, again, you can't rule anything out. And here's the problem. Probably the greatest advance in knowledge of honeybee biology was achieved last year. October 2006 was when the complete genome of the honeybee, the species Apis mellifera, was deciphered and decoded, I guess, and published. And really, that if this had to happen, it's a good time for, well, not that it's ever a good time, but it's timely, I guess, that we now have new tools for querying the bees in their absence to find out what those stressors are by looking at using a technique called microarray analysis to do gene profiling and see which groups of genes are different in the afflicted bees in comparison with the bees that don't appear to be affected by this, whatever it is. If it's a pathogen, then there should be some trace in the genome of a response of immune.
But wouldn't you have to have the dead body in order to make the comparison?
The ideal bees to examine would be the ones that are gone. And if we actually had put our hands on those, we wouldn't probably need to do expression profiling. But if a colony can be identified in the state of decline, then that would serve as a possible source of information. Here's the tricky part, though. bees are, again, very sophisticated society. And imagine if you woke up one morning, or if I woke up in Champaign-Urbana one morning and found that 80% of the population of Champaign-Urbana was missing. That imposes a stress. So it does for honeybees, too. It also imposes the remaining bees, the bees that remain behind. We don't know if they remain behind because they're immune to whatever this is or because they just haven't gotten around to succumbing yet. But be that as it may, they have to take care of all the jobs of the colony, so they're under an additional stress. So it's going to be very difficult to figure out how to find these clues. You know, sort of BSI instead of CSI. I'm not quite sure how one investigates in the absence of a.
Could be the making of a new television series. Who knows? How serious is this? I mean, when you see these statistics that 30 to 60% of the bee colonies have disappeared, in some states it appears to be as much as 70%, Jerry Bramenchenk, it sounds really dire. Is that something that can be replaced? I just don't know how easy it is to sort of repopulate, I guess, bee colonies.
Well, you have to be a little careful on the statistics. We've been doing the national surveys trying to get a handle on this, and as soon as we started that, we found out that although it was first reported in the southeast and Florida as those beekeepers went through their colonies in preparation of going to California, it actually started occurring at least as early as last spring in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa, and maybe even 1 to 2 years before. A couple years ago, the bee industry out in California had a fairly significant loss of bees, which is in part what caused the price of bees for the value of bees for rental pollination to almost triple in the last 2 years. But if you start looking at the, so we've been running surveys, talking to beekeepers, interviewing them. We probably have a better sense of what's going on from that standpoint than anyone. We're trying to figure out where it's been, where it's at now, and where it might be going. We published maps that said that currently we've documented it in 24 states. The caution here is not to think that it's full-blown in 24 states all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That means that some of these states are on the map because of their last spring, went through the heartland in the summer, showed up on the East Coast in the fall, played out in Oklahoma and Texas right around the first part of January, followed up and started getting reports out of Oregon and Washington. Individual beekeepers have been hit, and some of them have had dramatic losses. 40 to 60% losses for individual beekeepers whose operations are affected by this is not uncommon. 60 to 80% losses are fairly frequent, and there are a couple of beekeepers that have lost, and I'm talking big beekeepers, ones run thousands of hives, that have lost 80 to 100%. Fortunately, the proportion of the beekeepers in the country that are affected is still relatively low. It's hard to get a handle on that because there's no particular mechanism to find every beekeeper.
I'm sorry to interject, but we have to take a break. So let me just hold you there, and we'll come back to this question in particular and what can be done about it and whether or not the bee population can be replaced and how you go about doing that when we return. We welcome your calls as part of this conversation as well. If you have a question about bees or concerns about this topic, give us a call now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your questions at forum@kqed.org. More about the case of the missing bees when we return. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the missing bees, the role the bees play in the pollination of so many critical crops in American agriculture, and what's going on with the fact that so many beekeepers are discovering right now that their bees have gone missing. We're trying to figure that out this morning with a group of three scientists who are looking into that problem. May Birnbaum is the chair of the entomology department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Jerry Bramenchenk is at the University of Montana, where he is studying this issue. And Eric Musson, extension apiculturalist at the University of California, Davis, and the author of Beekeeping in California. Eric Musson, Jerry Bramenchenk before the break was describing the situation, what we know and what we don't know about how dire it is, and that it's sometimes sometimes hard to sort of track all the statistics. But I also want to get a handle on how difficult a problem this is to not only solve as far as figuring out what's going on, but even setting that aside for a moment, how easily can you repopulate? Is it really difficult to make up for this loss of bees?
Well, the bees themselves have an amazing ability to rebound if they live through this sort of thing and the food is available. They can build up very, very quickly. They tend to do that anyway in the spring and early summer. And then when they get some size to them, the beekeeper can split it in half or split it into thirds, add one or two new queens, and more or less have three colonies going. But the problem is, during the time that these are building up, they can't be rented for pollination. They're not strong enough. They can't make a honey crop. They're not strong enough. The beekeeper is simply returning to former numbers, but not accomplishing anything economically. In fact, it's costing the beekeeper. And
it's a tough business, right? I mean, this is not being a beekeeper. It's a sort of nomadic life. You take your bees to different states depending on which crops are coming due, and you don't necessarily make a lot of money. So the industry itself, I suspect, is also stressed, not just the bees.
Well, the industry has never been what you and I would call lucrative. You don't see a whole bunch of people clamoring to become beekeepers. In fact, many of the people who have been at it for a long time now, I think, would be very happy to find someone who would be willing to just relieve them of their operation, and they could take it easy for a while. It's very, very hard work, but it's for the beekeepers, they consider it also something very worthwhile because no one's telling them what to do. They run their own hours. They're responsible for their own things that happen or don't happen, and they like that independence.
Yeah. Lots of people calling in who want to participate in our conversation. We'll get to those calls in just a moment, but a couple of emails as well. Dave writes from University of California, Berkeley. This is an interesting and disturbing topic, the likelihood of sublethal toxic poisoning leading to behavioral deflects and imperils a whole population is also a popular hypothesis in regards to salmon decline. So unfortunately, this all may be coming too late for many key players in our ecosystem. Tanya writes, I'm wondering about the role of native bees in pollinating food crops. I hear from a local bee farmer that native bees have a big role and are currently healthy. What about that, Eric? Is there a difference in terms of native bees, or are California bees doing better than Floridian bees?
I think the differential here is the difference between bees in boxes kept by beekeepers versus, let's say, solitary pollinators that do their own thing and kind of live out in the wild. And in places where we're not using a whole lot of pesticides and the environment hasn't been whacked around too much, yes, indeed, there are non-apis pollinators out there that actually, there are enough of them in numbers and they're very good pollinators that they do pollinate commercial crops in some places.
A couple of people are writing on that point, and Jerry Bromanchek, let me get you to respond. One person writes in, the growers can't have it both ways. Pesticides kill insects, and bees are insects. It ain't rocket science. And someone else writes, I'm wondering if the bee disappearance happens also on organic farms, those farms supposedly that don't use pesticides. What about that?
Those are good questions, and unfortunately, yes, it does happen on organic farms. We've got organic beekeepers that tightly manage their colonies, put the bees on new foundation or wax, and don't use any chemicals at all, or only use very minimally more natural products. It doesn't give them any protection. As I said, this is a very democratic problem. Good beekeepers and bad beekeepers alike are experiencing it, and you can't point the finger and say, well, if you just kept better care of your bees, you wouldn't have the problem.
And not as simple as to say that farmers who are farming organically are not having this problem.
That's right. Now, as far as the growers and the beekeepers, there's always this potential conflict between the two, and it's really not so much a conflict, in my mind, between the growers and the beekeepers, because they try to orchestrate things very well so that they don't put the bees at risk. I mean, it's not in the best interest of a grower to kill the bees they just rented. But the general public requires a produce that is spotless, doesn't have any discoloration or any damage. And so since the general public in the supermarkets insists on that kind of a product, about the only way that the grower can provide it is heavy pesticide usage.
May Birnbaum pick up on that and the consequences for consumers. What would you like people to be thinking about this? Are there lessons that we ought to be thinking about in terms of either the way in which we want produce to look like, as Jerry Bromanchek is suggesting, or something else that you'd like people to just be more aware of during this kind of episode?
Well, the more successful entomologists have been at reducing the incidence of pest damage, the higher the bar is raised, and the higher the greater the expectations. So there's a general cultural aversion to insects where they don't belong. In fact, even bees. People love bees in their garden, but aren't too happy when there's a bee in the car.
Right.
Where, in the human perspective, it doesn't belong. And there is a bizarre paradox that people are, as Jerry says, insist on spotless produce, so they are trading off a harmless grub or two for pesticide residues. Although, again, everything's monitored. It's not, not clear whether there are individually risks associated with that pesticide use. Now, I'm not a bee biologist by any stretch of the imagination, but I got involved in bees, at least indirectly, first through honey, and then through my interest in enzymes that all animals use to detoxify pesticides, called cytochrome P450s. It's what we have in our liver to detoxify all the nasty things we come in contact with. And these genome projects have revealed some very interesting patterns across the insects. Most insects have this is a huge gene family. Most insects have 80, 90, 100 different enzymes that are associated with detoxification of pesticides and other natural or synthetic toxins. Honeybees have 46. They have half the normal or the typical inventory of detoxification enzymes. So that's a puzzle, too. How do they manage? Because they encounter flying through, as Jerry will attest, they fly through all kinds of things in the environment. They sample all kinds of nectars. They encounter all kinds of floral volatiles. They communicate with chemicals that they have to process. They have an incredibly sophisticated pheromonal communication system. And yet they do this with a fraction of the normal complement of enzymes that break things down.
Interesting. So, but that may also point back to why they are potentially vulnerable, and also this role, as Jerry was suggesting, they play to some extent as the miner's canary. Let's get to some of our calls this morning. Lots of people who want to participate in our discussion and have questions about where the bees have gone. Let's start with Tom, who joins us on the Sirius Satellite Network this morning from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering about African bees. A few years back, there were a lot of stories about a potential African bee invasion, that they are very aggressive but not nearly as good pollinators as honeybees. Is that still a threat on top of the current problem?
Tom, thank you. Who can take that?
This is Eric. I'll try. Africanized honeybees, number one, are not poor pollinators. They're very good pollinators unless you're going to have somebody working in the fields at the time that the bees are active. Then you don't want to put people and bees, Africanized bees, in the same place at the same time. They've been in Texas since the early 90s. They've been here in California since the early 90s, and they're in what you and I would call the feral areas. We can't do too much about that, but it appears as though the beekeepers can do a pretty good job of not having them in their colonies in California. In Arizona, it's a different thing. There's so many of them out there that now many of the beekeepers keep Africanized bees in their boxes in Arizona and keep them way, way far away from people.
But African bees aren't likely the cause of the missing problem, right?
No, we don't have any reason to believe that would be the case.
Yeah. Okay, let's go next to Susan, who joins us this morning in Forestville. Susan, go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. First, I was thinking that I realized that my manzanita tree a couple of weeks ago was in full bloom and was just covered with bees. They were going nuts. But my question is that I'd heard that last year there was a significant die out of wildflowers, and I was wondering if this had any correlation.
Great question. Thank you, Susan. May Birnbaum, can you tackle that?
Where was the report of the die out of wildflowers? Was that California?
Susan, I'm sorry, we just lost you. But she was calling from California, so I suspect.
Well, because I don't know. Maybe if Eric is aware of what exactly she was referring to. The flowers tend to be most flowers tend to be on the sort of promiscuous side when it comes to pollinator visits. So, in fact, our native plants, if they are pollinated by honeybees, that's an indication of their general laid-back attitude toward pollinators, because honeybees, of course, are not native to North America. So many species of plants are pollinated by an array of pollinators. So the loss of a particular pollinator in some cases could be devastating. There are a few examples, yucca moths and the yucca plants cannot set seed without pollination by a yucca moth.
So wildflowers could survive without honeybees, is that right?
Well, native flowers survived before honeybees got here. So as long as honeybees didn't, some people actually don't look very favorably upon honeybees because they're, in some respects, can be considered as invasive species. They're not native to North America. They've been brought over and has escaped from domestication and are such unbelievably efficient pollinators that they, under some circumstances, may outcompete and reduce the numbers of native species.
Yeah. Eric, anything you want to add on the wildflower thing, since it is a California-specific question?
Well, in some parts of the United States, you'd have to have a very peculiar drought in order not to have, you know, wildflowers, weeds, whatever you want to call them, through most of the year. But in California, it's bone dry all summer. And the beekeepers are always looking forward, they hope, to that late summer fall feed like tarweed or blue curls or something like that to feed their bees and build them up in the fall time. And last few years, we have not, well, it wasn't too bad at the end of 2005. But the year before that and this past year, 2006, those fall plants just weren't there, and that puts a terrible stress on the bees going into winter.
Jack is next. He's joining us from Davis this morning. Jack, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a pigeon flyer, and when I talk to the old pigeon flyers, they would say that they would lose a certain amount of birds when we would have races. But now we have a certain opportunity to throw out birds and have the entire flock just disappear. And so I was wondering whether or not it might have anything to do with microwaves. I've felt that the proliferation of all your cellular telephones and things like that, because our birds use all kinds of methods to find their way home. And I was wondering if anybody has thought of microwaves as being a potential problem.
Jack, thank you. Really interesting question. Jerry Bromanchek?
Yeah, I can take that question. Certainly, bees are sensitive to electromagnetic fields, and in some high tense, some big power lines, especially DC power lines, you don't want to really put your bees right underneath the power line. That said, we've seen collapsing colonies, thousands of colonies that are being lost in areas where there are no cell, there not only aren't cell towers, but you can't even get cell service in or out. So I don't think it's a likely candidate.
Thank you. Thanks for the call, Jack. And let's go next to Gary, who joins us this morning from Sacramento. Gary?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering about in the areas that have been impacted the worst, is there any indication that other types of insects, either colony-based or otherwise, have been disappearing too?
How about that, May Birnbaum?
About honeybees. I mean, the canary in the coal mine is a great analogy, because if there was a, sow bug in the coal mine that died, nobody would notice. Nobody would care. So one reason the honeybee disappearances have come to light is that people care. There's a special group of people who care very deeply about honeybees, you know, the beekeepers, and another group that depend on them, the people who grow crops pollinated by honeybees. So the vast majority of insect species with a complex social structure are either neutral with respect to most people, or millions of ants that are underneath, you know, that are tunneling, and or else are actively disliked. I mean, if for example, there was an equivalent of a colony collapse disorder in the Formosan termite, people would celebrate.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's hard to say. But I do have to admit to a certain prejudice that honeybees are, if it is a behavioral disturbance, nobody has such a, no other species of insect that I'm aware of has such a sophisticated set of behaviors.
Yeah, yeah. Gary, thanks very much for the call. Let me go through a couple of emails that are coming in. Britta writes, where are there still healthy colonies, and does the answer reveal a pattern? For example, are bee colonies in the mountains or away from cities? Are they in better shape? Jerry, any thoughts on that?
Well, so far our surveys, and that's one of the things that we're asking, that's a very good question, and we won't really know that answer until May, because all we've heard of from the moment of the beekeepers who pollinate, that is, they have to go out and look at their colonies, they're being graded as they go into the crops, but the largest number of beekeepers in the U.S., they don't necessarily all have, they're not the largest number of colonies of bees. The pollinators that run 5, 10, 15, 20,000, up to 60,000 colonies, the hobbyists, the sideliners, they far outnumber the commercial beekeepers in terms of number of beekeepers, but they'll have 2, 3, 5, 50, 100, 500 colonies. For the most part, those colonies went into the winter and put to bed and have not been looked at until just about now. So all of a sudden, our surveys are starting to swell as beekeepers go out and look at them. But the preliminary looks, no, unfortunately, there's no safe place for your bees. In the sense that we could predict that there'd be a place that you would put them and they wouldn't experience this.
Similar question from Reed, who writes in Oakland, also wondering about the geographical aspects of this. He writes, fascinating program. You haven't discussed yet whether Canadian and Mexican beekeepers are having the same problem, or European and Asian beekeepers. Is there an international organization monitoring all of this to see what's going on worldwide? Eric, can you help us with that? Are we seeing anything different in this country that's not going on elsewhere around the world?
We don't know the causes, but no, we're not seeing something different here because, yes, they are having a significant problem in Europe. Canadians haven't talked about it too much. They may be having a little of it, but they're not having it like we're having it. So, but in Europe, they have found some, well, they're trying to put pieces together and think they found the cause over there, but we've looked over here and found the things that they're blaming the disease on, and we have healthy bees with those characteristics that they're using for the reason. So it's more than just the U.S., but it's still a mystery.
And back to our calls. Let's take one next from Cindy, who joins us this morning from Oakland. Cindy, go ahead.
Hi. 2-3 years ago, when I moved to California, a swarm of bees moved into a wall on a railing next to my house. And if this should happen again or to anybody else, is there someone to call so that you don't have to suffer walking by a whole bunch of bees every time you go in and out of your house, but you don't have to destroy the bees either? Is there someone at Davis or something?
Okay, Cindy, thanks for the call. Not exactly the part of the problem we're exploring this morning, but that's okay. Eric, go ahead.
The answer's quick. Usually in the yellow pages, under the word beekeeper or beekeeping, there's at least one person, if not more, that lists their availability to go out and collect swarms. And so that would be the best place to start.
Mark writes from San Francisco this morning, do bees take their honey when they abandon their hives? If they do, perhaps they're responding to a chemical accumulating in their hives. That's an interesting theory. May Birnbaum, what about that?
Well, the reports are that these abandoned colonies are full of honey. And in fact, as Jerry mentioned earlier, the freakish thing is bees are opportunists. They tend to, if a colony's been abandoned, they'll move in and steal take the honey. But nobody, not even the pests, not even the interlopers in the beehives, seem to be moving immediately into these abandoned colonies. So if they're is contamination that suggests that it's pretty widespread and may even include contaminated honey, contaminated pollen. But we don't know.
Mm. Can I jump in on this real quick?
Yeah, please.
One of the symptoms of this thing is that when beekeepers see colonies start to fail, they immediately recognize what Eric's talking about, nutritional deficiencies, and tend to throw supplemental food on them. They'll give them syrup, they'll give them pollen, natural pollen or pollen substitutes. In this particular case here, they won't take it. Once this starts, they won't touch it, just like you and I. If we got stomach flu, we're not interested in food.
Hmm. Joe has a question next from Burlingame this morning. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. I know that there was a bee mite that struck the populations, and I was just wondering, what's the status of the bee mite, and is it possible that that's been a vector, for example, for, a virus or something that's the underlying cause?
Jerry Bramanchuk, take that, please.
Well, certainly the mites, that's all true. We've had mites. The mites can be devastating. They do vector some of the viruses, and there's even something called parasitic mite syndrome that was unfortunately dubbed PMS. But and we sometimes see some things similar to this, and it may be involved, but this is playing out in a different way, and the symptoms are dissimilar from what we'd expect typically from that. There are groups at Penn State, and we're working with a U.S. Army lab in Aberdeen, trying to take as one of the, you know, again, looking for clues, looking for viruses, but there's no definitive answers yet.
More of your emails coming in. Holly writes, whether or not the bee problem is a result of an ecological problem, promoting healthy ecosystems on farms and other agricultural land is good for bees and other critical species and habitat. Sylvia writes, Rudolf Steiner predicted the massive decline of the honeybee 75 years ago. If the practices used by commercial beekeepers continued, we would lose the bees. Many things are done to the bees which are unnatural, and they would finally be stressed beyond the breaking point. So a number of people, I think, keep coming back to this question about whether or not there's something wrong with contemporary practices, whether that's the use of pesticides or, in this case, Sylvia is wondering about the practices of beekeepers themselves. Eric Musson, is this perhaps some sort of indictment of contemporary farming practices or bee practices?
Well, a while before the mite showed up in the bees in the United States, the worst thing in the world in the eyes of the beekeepers was a pesticide, particularly an insecticide or something like that that would hurt their bees in the field. And they were really, really concerned. Then all of a sudden, these exotic mites showed up, particularly Varroa mite, which came off of another species of bee over in Asia. So our honeybees have no innate resistance or tolerance to that mite. And the mite was absolutely devastating. So when a pesticide became available that would kill mites within the hive and have the bees survive, the beekeepers kind of had to bite their tongue and go ahead and use it. So we've gone through a few of those, and now we're trying to use softer things. But, yes, you still have to treat or else the mites will kill the colonies if they're being used commercially. The hobby beekeepers don't see this problem nearly as bad.
And let's get in one more caller. Tom joins us from Berkeley. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah. I was curious about, one of your just talked about the invaders who come in and attempt to take food out of the nest. How often does that happen without this particular problem going on? What's the general rate? Is it something that is seen normally? Is the 2 weeks a bad amount of time or the standard amount of time?
May Birnbaum, can you answer that?
Well, that's more of a Jerry's line of...
Okay, Jerry?
Unprotected equipment is safe for about all 30 seconds before the invaders start to move in. We've driven bees from Montana to Maryland, stopped the trailer, and before we could get off of out of the truck and back to the trailer, there were wax moths flying in, even with colonies that had bees in them. Now, normally they're repulsed or kept under control by the bees. Hive beetles are very aggressive moving in, and if you're working bees and leave open comb and so on while you're working through the colonies, those invaders will be there. I mean, for them not to be there almost the moment that the box becomes vulnerable, either because the beekeeper opened it or because it's the population too weak to defend it, is unusual. The two-week thing's unprecedented.
Yeah. We just have a moment left. Fascinating program. Lots of listener interest you can tell this morning about this problem. So let's just spend a last moment or two on what we need to do to figure out this crime. We talked throughout the program about how tricky this is. It's clear there is no simple answer. It's clear that it's especially complex because there are no dead bodies. So, May Birnbaum, what do we need to do to begin to understand what's going on?
Well, certainly this crisis is, if in fact it is a crisis, I mean, well, for beekeepers it is, points out the fact that really pollination biology in general is grotesquely underfunded, undersupported. It is. I was chair of a National Academy of Sciences committee charged with determining whether or not there's a pollination crisis. This is an idea that's been around for 20 years, and our conclusion basically is we have such poor information, we don't even know what we're losing. So considering the birds and the bees are the sort of archetypal, universally well-known, ecological interactions, it's amazing how little we really know about it. And I think this has been, I hate to use the phrase wake-up call, but that certainly points out how abysmally unprepared we are
to deal
with a pollination crisis, if in fact one were to arrive.
And Eric Musson, what would you add to that in terms of where we ought to sort of focus our resources best at this point?
Well, like with plants, when they plants are having a problem with disease or whatnot, there's always a hope that through selection of stocks, we can come up with something finally that resists or at least tolerates, you know, the mites, the diseases, and all that sort of thing. So there are a number of individuals in the research areas around the country and some of the commercial beekeepers and whatnot who are breeding or trying to breed and select from the stocks that they have, the ones that are performing best under these serious stresses that they're placed under. And hopefully, at some point in time, maybe we can just, you know, get tougher bees and be able to fight the problems that way.
We have to leave it there, but just a quick word, please, Jerry Bromanchak. Are you optimistic? Do you think you're going to figure this out?
I'm hoping they will, and your viewers could, or your listeners could help us if they would encourage beekeepers, whether they got one hive or 10,000, to go to www.beesurvey.com and fill out our questionnaires. Information is what we desperately need.
Great. Thanks all very much. Jerry Bromanchak is a professor at the University of Montana. He joined us this hour along with Eric Musson, an extension apiculturalist at the University of California, Davis, and May Birenbaum, the chair of the entomology department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you all very much for being part of our program. Really interesting. Tell by the amount of listener call and email how much people are concerned about this particular topic. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. Coming up in our second hour of Forum this morning, we're going to turn to the topic of wine and the legacy of Ernest Gallo, who passed away this week at the age of 97. We'll take that up next. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.